Good morning, church. If you have a Bible, turn to Proverbs chapter 5. If you got one, turn to Proverbs 5. If you don't have one, halfway down the aisles, as usual, are some red Bibles that you can borrow. And right in the middle there, just maybe slight to the right of the middle, is Proverbs. Find chapter 5. How many of you had sex education when you were in school? I did. I went to public school, had sex education. How many of you have had sex education in church? Let me just see. You will after today. Well, if you're visiting with us, let me explain what we're up to, because it is a bit unusual. At Desert Springs, we're generally studying books of the Bible on Sunday morning. We take a book of the Bible and try to go through it. We take a book rather than just a theme or a topic, because that's how God's Word was revealed to us. It was revealed in books of the Bible. It's not just a kind of haphazard collection of miscellaneous verses and bits of wisdom and truth. It's revealed in books in specific contexts, and we like to look at that and see what it says. But doing that also means that we can't avoid hard passages, passages that are hard to understand, passages that we don't like to talk about, passages that are make us squirm, perhaps. And Proverbs 5 is one of those passages, because it talks very intimately, very descriptively about the marital bed, about sex. We've been in Proverbs for a while, and in the last several weeks, we've talked about relationships, romance, sex, and sexuality, and we'll do that again today. So we should tell you, if you're visiting or you forgot, because this will be some steamy material for church talk, normally we would encourage your kids to be in here with you, but if they're of the age, kind of that middle age, where they're going to ask, "Daddy, what does that mean?" They may do that, so you have to be prepared for that. You may want to take them to a class now, because we will, as I said, be pretty free in talking about this thing of sex, bluntly, freely, honestly, as it's revealed here in the Bible. But of course, that's up to you to decide if you should do that or not. Now, if you weren't here in the last couple of weeks, let me encourage you to listen online to the sermons or to get the CDs at the Resource Center. So much of what I say this morning will be things that we said last week, and they're just assumed. I may say them in a statement. I may just have them in the back of my mind as I say something else this morning. And I can't take the time, obviously, to go back and reprove, to re-defend, to re-articulate what we said in those previous weeks. And so let me encourage you to listen to those. But what we said, in short, was this: that God created sex as good, that He gave it as a gift between husband and wife, but when sin entered the world, it has warped all things, including sex. And so this good thing now is twisted into all kinds of misuse. As Christians, we're forgiven of sin in general, and sexual sin specifically, but it doesn't stop there. Now we should flee temptation to misuse sex, and we should instead work to see it restored in our lives. We should look to see this gift that God has given us in marriage to be expressed in its beauty of intimacy and love and joy, to raise up kids that one day will get married and see this expressed in their home as well. So, 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. Do you believe that your marital bed can either be done to or against the glory of God? Do you believe the glory of God touches that corner of your life? Say yes if you do. But we'll see. We'll see who flinches first. All right? This is some heavy stuff, and so let's dig into it. The first thing I want to talk about is why talk about sex in church. And we've hinted at this before already in previous weeks, but I want to repeat some and say some more. We talk about sex in church because it's biblical. It's here in the Bible. We're preaching through Proverbs. We come to Proverbs 5. It would be an omission to not talk about it. It's not just in Proverbs 5 and 6 and 7, three whole chapters, but there's a whole book that describes a romance scene between two lovers coming together, even talking about their wedding and their wedding night in some graphic detail of poetry. There are references scattered all through the Bible, some Some condemning this act of sexual action. Some commending this act of sexual action. It shows us what is good about it. It shows us what's bad about it. There are stories and there are principles scattered everywhere in the Bible. We need to talk about this, though, because the world is talking about it and the church isn't, unfortunately. And when the world is talking about it and the church refuses to talk about it, I dare say that we send the implicit message to our kids, the next generation, or send the implicit message to our unbelieving friends or even people not a part of our church, maybe even back to ourselves, so that we wouldn't say this maybe out loud, but by our actions we seem to almost think, when we never ever talk about sex in church, that maybe, just maybe, there's something dirty about it. That God's glory doesn't reach that corner of our lives, or His word doesn't speak to that corner of our lives. We need to talk about sex in church because this is part of our sanctification too. Sex is a place where you see your own selfishness, or you get to love selflessly. It's part of growing in grace in knowledge. People talk about growing in their prayer life. I don't hear anybody say, "It's been a great year, really grown in my sex life." That'd make your home group an interesting night, wouldn't it? It's part of sanctification. Think of it in the language of Romans 12. Remember, Romans 12 says, "Be not conformed to this world, but be transformed." We think of it in terms of our sexual relationships, our sexuality even. Don't be conformed to the world's sexuality, but let your sexuality be transformed according to God's word. And remember that "be transformed" there is ongoing. As Christians, we are not immediately transformed. We are being transformed. And in our sexuality as Christians, we are not transformed because we're married and having sex, or we're Christians who are married and having sex. We are being transformed even in our sexuality as Christians. At least I hope so. I pray so. So it shouldn't just be talked about among Christians. I think we should be a little more freer than we are. Of course, you could overdo it. You could, guys, tell intimate stories of what happened last week or last night to your friends, and your wife would not appreciate that. But I think in Christian circles, conservative Christian circles, we err on the other side of it. It's just so taboo, so private, so otherworldly. So, I don't know, we just feel really nervous talking about it. Proof of that is the expressions I see this week and last week and the week before as I've talked about this. The first service, I mean, you have some people looking like they're, you know, they're writing this down. It's going to be great tonight. And then you have other people just going, "I wish I wasn't here." So if that's you, if you want to pretend like it's the first day of school and you're in the wrong class and you want to leave right now, go ahead and do that, because it's going to get a lot worse from here, or a lot better, depending on your view. But we will talk about it. Al Mohler, the president of Southern Seminary in Kentucky, says this about the problem of not talking about it: "Christians have no right to be embarrassed when it comes to talking about sex and sexuality. An unhealthy reticence or embarrassment in dealing with these issues is a form of disrespect to God's creation. Whatever God made is good, and every good thing God has made has an intended purpose that ultimately reveals His own glory. When conservative Christians respond to sex with ambivalence or embarrassment, we slander the goodness of God and hide God's glory, which is intended to be revealed in the right use of creation's gifts." I love the way it's put in Proverbs 30 in verse 18. I'll put this up on the screen. Look at this. "There are three things," the writer says, "which are too wonderful for me, four which I don't understand. The way of an eagle in the sky." How does he soar and never flaps his wings? I think that's what's getting at there. "The way of a serpent on a rock. How does he move when he doesn't have legs? The way of a ship in the middle of the sea. How do they navigate when they can't see the land, when it's dark out? How do they do it? I know they do it, but I don't know how they do it," he says. "And the way of a man with a maid." The way of a man with a girl. I don't understand girls. I don't understand romance is what he's saying here. But he's not saying it's mystery like it's frustrating. It's not frustratingly mysterious. It is gloriously mysterious. He doesn't say, I'm frustrated by eagles never flapping their wings. At least not that much. He's saying, I don't get it, but it's marvelous. And he's saying, I don't get sex and sexuality and romance and moving into intimacy with a woman. I don't understand it, but it's marvelous. Here's a description of the marvelous intimate marital bed. Verse 15 of Proverbs 5. This is our main passage. Drink water from your own cistern, fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad? Should streams of water be spread in the streets? Let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love, for why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. Well, that leads us to the second point, if you're following along in the notes up here on the screens. It's the wonderful sharing of parts and passion in marriage. That's my summary of these verses. A wonderful sharing of parts and passion in marriage. And I don't mean, guys, auto parts. I mean parts. I'm talking parts here because parts were mentioned here in the passage. One of the keys of the passage is that it's constantly distinguishing between the right use of sex in marriage and the misuse of sex outside of marriage. We've seen that in Proverbs 6 and in Proverbs 7, where that was really emphasizing the misuse of sex outside of marriage. Here in Proverbs 5, both are discussed. Earlier, it had talked about the adulterous woman, the temptation to stay away from her door, to not give in to her. The alternative? The alternative is not only just what's right and what's good, but it's also the means by which you fight the temptation to go anyplace else, to have it anyplace else, to misuse it in any way. The nature of these springs, look at verse 15, emphasizes that this is not public. This is not public affection. This is not loose affection. This is not dispersed affection. It's drink water from your own cistern. Your own. Your own well. Your water should stay at home. You shouldn't pour your water into the streets. You think about the way that you probably won't share a glass of water with someone you don't know. Someone probably who's even, unless they're really close to you. You wouldn't just say, yeah, here, have a drink. You think, I don't know where you've been. I don't know what you've kissed. I don't know what you ate today. I don't know if you have onion breath, let alone disease or germs or something. And so you wouldn't maybe share your water with those who aren't very close and intimate to you. Why would you spread your waters abroad? Why would you share your water with people? The very nature of our water is that it's our water. It's our bedroom's water, you could say. It's not public. It shouldn't be dispersed into the streets. It's not a public well for public dipping. It's intended to be within the covenant of marriage. So this is not a blanket celebration of sexuality. This is not sexuality in general. This is not a celebration of the act of sex. This is a celebration of marriage, the ongoing consummation of the marital relationship in lovemaking, which is central to the healthy marriage and is also the God-given alternative to sexual sin. Now, let me say something quickly to unmarried people here before we get into really more graphic sexual language, which might make all of us nervous, but it might make for some unmarried folks here wonder why they came, wonder why they stayed after we announced the topic, wonder if they should really sit through a detailed discussion of breasts when they can't look and can't touch yet. Should they really listen to this? Yes, you should. You should. It is good for you to be here. It's good for you to hear this. It will be weird and uncomfortable, but let that be a lesson in and of itself. Because unless you're a preteen, you're used to sexuality out there in the world all over the place. You're used to sexual stories. You're used to seeing sexual scenes on television. You're used to hearing it talked about pretty loosely in sitcoms, if not also at work. You're used to the sexual discussion. You're just not used to having it here. And that's wrong. That's not good. It's not that I'm single, and so I just try to remove every discussion, thought, anything that will remotely remind me of the S word. And I don't mean the one that is about poop. I mean the other S word. I can't go there. Come on. None of us live on that desert island. No single person thinks that they can withdraw themselves from the world in such a way to never hear about sex. So you need to hear it from God's word. And you need to hear it as a description, as it's intended by God within marriage. So this part of the Bible, Proverbs 5, Song of Solomon, this topic in the Bible serves this purpose for you if you're not married, whether you're a teenager or you're 20-something or you're 50-something and you're not married. This passage shows you the beauty and the glory and the joy and the fulfillment of sex in marriage. It reminds you that that thing you have called sexuality does have a place where it is supposed to be fulfilled. Now, I know that means that a spouse has to come along, and that's harder for ladies who usually are not the pursuers instead of the responders to the man's pursuit. You have to trust God in that. I know it's hard. You need to pray. You need to study God's word and be encouraged with truth. But you also need to see here that this passage is describing the highest expression of marital love, and you can rejoice in it even if you're not married. You can rejoice in what this should be in God's plan and hopefully will be in your life later in life. Maybe not, but maybe. So this should have the effect on you to remain pure until you're married. Or to remain pure until you're married again. And it should have the effect on you, if you're of marriable age, to not stall. To not stall in getting married. We'll come back to that in a little bit. We'll come back to the unmarried folks in a little bit. But because I knew you would be wondering about married people or unmarried people listening to this, I thought we would talk about it up front. Back to the passage. Notice there's a privatization of privates in this passage. And I mean privates. I don't mean military people. I mean privates here. The privates are discussed. Parts are discussed. But they're private. It's celebrated in the bedroom. Remember, these are not public privates. These are private privates. And that means that in our culture where we uniquely publicize privates, our culture, no doubt, because of the technological advances we have to get images of privates or bits of privates out there in the world, there is no way any other culture competes with our sea of sexuality, our sea of displaying, publicizing parts. What it means for Christian men and women is that there needs to be modesty on our part. There's an issue of modesty here for women. It means for husbands, husbands, don't let your wives maybe go out with certain things on. Maybe you say to her, honey, I really like the way you look in that. But that's exactly the problem. I really like the way you look in that. And I'm afraid other guys are going to really like the way you look in that too. And those are mine. Those are my parts. Those are mine. They're not for the streets. They're not for the streams out there. It's an issue of men's eyes as well. Your eyes are for your wife's body, not another's. And some of it you can't help but see. Some of it you can help see. And where you can't help see it, you remind yourself of where sexuality is supposed to go. You're reminded of the joy and the pleasure of it in marriage, not outside of marriage. Why should you be exhilarated by another woman? It says in verse 20. In marriage, there's not the privatization of privates, at least in the bedroom. There is the celebration of privates in this passage. We were made to like parts. You know that? We were made to like parts. Now, there's definite nakedness going on here in Proverbs 5. It should remind us of a theme. Remember at the beginning of the Bible? Adam and Eve sinned and they were naked and what? Ashamed. And they covered themselves up. They put leaves on them to cover up their private parts. When it says they were naked and ashamed, I think that that's real and physical. But I think there's also some symbolism there. All of a sudden now they have things to hide. All of a sudden now they have reasons to be embarrassed. All of a sudden now they have reasons to be awkward with one another. Sin has broken down the relationship. And the breakdown in the relationship has all kinds of consequences and fingerprints, not least in the physical realm. Not least in their physical relationship. In other words, the issue of nakedness does relate to sin in general, the fall, as it happened in the book of Genesis. And what that means for the celebration of nakedness in the confines of marriage between a husband and a wife, what it means is that the free, uninhibited, unembarrassed celebration of our spouse's nakedness in Jesus is part of restoring what was broken in the fall. You hear that? You realize how big this is? This isn't just about I get to, I want to, I like to. Well, she wants me to, I have to. It's not about any of those things. Do you realize that there is a redemptive work in enjoying the nakedness of your spouse? It's part of participating in God's plan to restore what got broken when sin entered this world. It doesn't mean now that we have public nakedness, but it means that part of our oneness as husband and wife, part of the intimacy of growing closer together, part of the sacrifice of love, the exchange of commonality, of life, sharing life together, gets expressed in the bedroom with nakedness, not coverings. I think that's neat. I think it's theologically neat. I think it's also sexually neat, too. All right, let's look at this sensuous description. It's probably more sensual than you thought. Verse 15, when it says, drink water from your own cistern, fresh water from your own well. Cistern and well here are pictures of female sexuality. These are images of her most intimate, private part. The well. You go into a well. You getting the picture here? Unlike what it says of the spring. Should your springs be dispersed abroad? Or in verse 18, let your fountain be blessed. This is a picture of male sexuality. It's a picture of the most intimate male part. And when it says, let your fountain be blessed, some might think that that means that you would have kids. But you know, there's nothing in this passage about productivity in sex. It's about pleasure. It's not about procreation in this passage. That's a good thing. That's part of why we do that. But this passage doesn't mention procreation. It's all about pleasure. So when it says, let your fountain be blessed, I think it's referring to his sexual vitality. Maybe hoping he'd be like Moses. Get this, Deuteronomy 34, verse 7. Of Moses, it says that he died at the age of 120, and, quote, his vigor was not abated. And the commentators are almost unanimous in that this means the guy didn't need Viagra at 120. Moses was a stud, and that's impressive. I've got to hand it to him. Okay, so may your fountain be blessed means I hope it's good and I hope it goes on for a long time. And these are pictures of water, right? A well, let your fountain be blessed. Why water? It symbolizes satisfaction and thirst. a desire being quenched and satisfied. But it's even elevated in verse 19. Another water image. Verse 19, be exhilarated. This isn't exactly a water image. It's a liquid image. It's literally meaning to be intoxicated or drunk. Be drunk on your wife's love. You know, in Ephesians 5, it says, don't be drunk with wine, but be drunk with the Holy Spirit. There's one other thing you can be drunk with. Your wife or your husband, your spouse. You can be drunk in the sexuality of the marriage relationship. You can be drunk in marital intimacy, tipsy. The adulterous woman uses a word like this in chapter 7, verse 18. Would you look at that? Chapter 7, verse 18. Come, let us drink our fill. Drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. Now, she's not knowing, of course, the beauty of these words in their marital context, but it's basically describing the same thing, drinking fill. Bruce Waltke, in his great commentary in the book of Proverbs, says it's the concept of quenching thirst by being drenched. It's like quenching thirst with a fire hose, getting intoxicated. It says in verse 18, let her breasts satisfy you always. Again, Bruce Waltke, written maybe the most standard, classic, modern classic commentary on the book of Proverbs. He says that this Hebrew word for breasts here originated as infant's babble. So maybe in your home, maybe passed down from generations, the babies always go, knock knock or kiki, or, you know, and it meant mommy's breast. They usually say it when they want milk or something. Kiki was one in our family, not our immediate family, but the weird Kellys and further back down the road, they used to say kiki about it. And maybe that's the kind of thing you can familiarize yourself with. It's infant babble here. The Hebrew word is breast that originated as infant babble, but later, here's the key. Waltke says the word was associated with erotica. And that seems to be how it's used here in Proverbs 5 and elsewhere in the Old Testament, according to Waltke. You can see it used in Ezekiel 23 three different times, and it has a very sensual overtone. The point is that our English word, breast, is very anatomical. It's very sterile, isn't it? It's very formal. Though there's something very sexual about the Hebrew word for breast being used here. It's not crass, it's not vulgar, but it's not clinical either. It's sensual and erotic without being derogatory or just physical, just anatomical. I don't think that we have an English word to be used here that would be better than breasts in our English translations. I don't think we have an English word that is sensual and erotic, but yet not derogatory. But that's what's being used here, and it's worth noting. It's worth noting that there's a risque overtone to it here, a sanctified risque overtone here. Look at verse 19 when it says, a loving hind and a graceful doe. Why does he say that she's like Bambi, a deer? You can think of a lot of reasons why they say in most of the commentaries this is used here, is that it's a symbol of agility and grace and beauty. If you talked about the beauty of a deer, you probably wouldn't speak of it just being still. You'd speak of it running, prancing. So what a lot of commentators say is that this description here is not just beauty in itself, this is beauty in motion. These breasts are supposed to satisfy you like a loving hind and a graceful doe, like a dancing deer. It's used like this in Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 5, where it says of a woman's breasts, they are as twin fawns. Again, not just beauty in themselves. It's more than that. It's some kind of beauty in motion here. This is a celebration of, not a snapshot of the bedroom. This is a celebration of an intimate and full description. If you blush here, you'd blush even more at Song of Solomon. Proverbs 5 is said to be something like a nugget version of the whole book of the Song of Solomon. But it isn't just sex. Remember, there's intimacy here. As you see it more in Song of Solomon with all the words exchanged back and forth. But there's intimacy and there's trust and there's love and there's commitment and there's romance. You see in chapter 2 of Proverbs that the adulterous woman leaves her companion, her husband, her first husband, when she leaves him to go find another lover, she leaves her companion. The word basically means best friend. Here, Proverbs is describing what marriage should be. She shouldn't be leaving her companion. Instead, she should be with her companion, not someone unknown. Next, let me talk about what 1 Corinthians 7 says about sharing of bodies. 1 Corinthians 7. We'll put it up on the screens. If you want to turn your Bibles, do so, but let me read it. In verse 3, very similar words, and here in the context of marital love, sex. It says the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her body, but the husband does. That first part right there, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. You might think, oh, Roman culture, first century, derogatory, you know, lowered the class, the state of women in such a way. Typical Paul the Apostle, as many non-Christians would view him. But look at the next phrase. Very anti-cultural. In the first century, for Paul to say, likewise, the husband does not have authority over his body. His wife does. She may not be able to vote in first century times, but she's in charge of him. She's in charge of his body. Her body is his, and his body is hers. It says in verse 5, stop depriving one another. Don't hold back. Don't give less. Except by agreement for a time so that you may devote yourself to prayer. Now, I don't know what this means. I thought about this verse before. Verse 5, Paul says, don't not have sex unless you agree together to not have sex for a time. And you agree to not have sex for a time so that you can pray. I can't imagine saying to my wife, let's just go like a whole month so we'll pray more. I would say, well, let's do it and then we'll pray. Right? I'll think better. I'm kind of frustrated right now and getting a little, my prayer life is, you know, I just kind of complain to the Lord. Maybe I'd feel better if we prayed afterwards, right? I'm sure it's my immaturity spiritually, but I don't know if I would be so busy that I couldn't pray and have sex in that same day. But nonetheless, that's not the point. The point is here, stop depriving one another. You don't not have sex unless you both agree to not have sex. And if you do this, Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Notice the beginning of this is put in terms of duty. You might not like that. You might say, you're not supposed to talk about sex as duty. I know what you mean. If all it is duty, that is wrong. It does sound unromantic. But it is duty. Exodus 21 describes provision, protection, and conjugal relations as the very basics of husbandry. The very basics of being a husband and doing husband work to your wife is making sure there's food, making sure there's protection, and making sure there's sex. Those are the basics. Of course, there's a lot more in Scripture, but in Exodus 21, those are the absolute basics. You must fulfill your duty. It should be more than duty, but if you're not doing it at all, then you're not even doing your duty. Abstaining is by mutual consent only in verse 5. Ladies, do you spurn? Do you spurn your husband's advances? If I asked each of you, how many times in a week would you think it's normal? And you said 2, and he said 14? We would talk with him about the unrealisticness of unreality of that. But you should talk about why it's so different, shouldn't you? You should talk about that. Do you perhaps fake the famous headache? Or use sex as a pawn in your power struggle of your relationship problems? Your parts are not your own. Let me be really specific and graphic when I say that. Your parts are not your own. When it says your body is not your own in 1 Corinthians 7, what's it talking about? Your elbow's not your own. Your fingers are not your own. Your eyes are not your own. It means your whole body. But it also means in the context of sexual relationships, your sexual parts. Your sexual parts are not your own. That means, as far as I'm concerned, my sexual parts are primarily for the pleasure of my spouse, not me. As far as I'm concerned, oh, I know it's not totally a selfless act. I know there's no way of avoiding the pleasure in it. Yes, but you have to see this. You have to see that the primary purpose of your parts, men and women, is not your pleasure, but a tool. It's for the other person. That's your responsibility to see that, to view it that way. That means that marital love should be more about giving some than getting some. It shouldn't be about getting some alone. I know that my, and I'm sure you'd agree, your very best times of intimate joy have been when you have scored big in pleasing your spouse. Those are the best times, not when, you know, you're done, that's it, roll over, fall asleep, and didn't even work up any kind of energy there, or burn off any calories there. No. Oh, the most wonderful stuff is the stuff when my wife is happy. So that means it's not about my wants being met as much as me meeting her wants. It's not as much about my fantasies being fulfilled as me wondering what her fantasies are. And notice it says in 1 Corinthians 7 that this will keep the devil away. An apple a day keeps the doctor away? Well, maybe once a day in the bedroom keeps the devil away. Mark Driscoll, a pastor in Seattle, he says that when people come to him for counseling, couples come to him for counseling with marital problems, he often says to them, here's the first assignment, doctor's prescription. You go home and every night for 2 weeks, you have sex. I don't care if you feel like it or not. It's a prescription. You do it. And when they come back 2 weeks later, they often have a lot fixed already. A lot of the so-called unrelated issues in their marriage, unrelated to sex, all of a sudden now got solved just by being more intimate together. Maybe try that one out. Fourth, how to pursue contentment with celebration. I want to talk about contentment here as a key, but contentment sounds bad, doesn't it? It sounds like an old guy telling you, well, it's as good as it gets. It's only downhill from here. You might as well be content. Contentment sounds like get used to it or tough up or something like that. But that's not what's being talked about here. Contentment is being talked about, but it's contentment that is unto celebration. You do fight some contentment by not being distracted elsewhere. In other words, you fight contentment by removing other temptations sometimes. Part of being content with your spouse is not playing the comparison game. Wives often compare the sensibility and sensitivity of the TV husband to their schmuck of a husband. Get real aggravated. How come you can't be like him? Well, he's on TV. That's one reason why I can't. That's not even him. He's just an actor. Guys, we do this in a more visual way, don't we? You have to be careful of avoiding comparisons of other women with your wife. When the culture around us does not have the biblical view of beauty. When in the first century, when in biblical times, comparing women to woman, that meant in one single town. If you were looking for a wife or you had a wife and you were tempted to compare that woman with other women, you would be limited based on the women you know who were pretty modestly dressed. You didn't see a lot of skin. You didn't know curves could look like that or they could be that big or anything like that. You didn't know. You didn't compare except what you just saw.
in faces. And even then, you're only comparing with what you had in your town. In our global age, here's what our wives, what our young girls are comparing themselves with. So out of love for them, let me say, guys, to you, out of love for them and in sympathy for the struggle they have where they are constantly comparing themselves to ridiculously perfect, unrealistic models, you should not compare. It will ruin your marriage. It will ruin your love. Here's what we're up against. In our day and age, you find the prettiest people of all over the world. You starve them to death. You give them surgery to enhance this, to tuck that in. And then you get the best lighting. You get the most talented photographers. Wind is blowing. Hair is flowing back behind her. The very best makeup artists have gone to town on her. And then they take 100 photos and they use one of them, the only one that's the best. And then of that one that they do use, they just doctor it up to remove every blemish. They want to make her 20 pounds lighter. They can. They can just stretch it. And some guy is on his couch, Mr. Beer Gut, Hairy Belly Guy, is on his couch going, I wish my wife could look like that. She wouldn't marry you. And here's the other thing. You wouldn't want to marry that girl because she's been starving herself since she was 14 and she's grouchy. Really, really grouchy. Women need food. So there's proof that would not be a happy home despite how she looks. You pursue contentment by noticing, by constantly remarking, avoiding what you can avoid, but what you can't avoid, you need to constantly mark. That's not real. That's not marriage. That's not love. The real stuff comes with intimacy and romance and friendship and oneness. Contentment needs to be pursued with celebration. Celebrate your wife, guys. Make your wife secure and safe. And hence, a passionate, free, uninhibited lover, make her secure and safe when you show her, when you continually demonstrate to her a singular passion for her and her body. It is your job, guys, to make her feel sexy. And even when the body does different things, through pregnancy, after pregnancy, at 40, when things are bigger, when things are smaller, when things are tighter, when things are droopier, when things... Here's what I want to say is it's your work to rejoice in your wife. Ladies, it is your work. It is your calling to rejoice in your husband. Do you see in verse 18? This is a command. Rejoice in your wife. Verse 19 is a command. Be drunk on her body, drunk in her love. Work to enjoy it. Think about their good stuff, not their bad stuff. Maybe you think a lot more about your spouse's faults than their good qualities. You say, well, I know all the good qualities, that's why I married her. But I keep thinking about all the stuff she needs to change. Yeah, and she's thinking the same thing for you, buddy. How's that working? Work to enjoy. Don't go making lists about their bad things. In your head, or on paper, or to their face. Rejoice in what God has given you. This is the spouse God has given you. God has given you this spouse. It might be a trial, it might be a blessing, and likely it's a big bundle of both of those, trial and blessing. But it is your bundle of trial and blessing. And you must rejoice, or you don't have a chance. You don't have a chance. Remember that this, last week we saw, is a slippery slope, and you think you can jump off. You think that you can maybe dabble in this a little bit. but not go all the way. But sin is seductive, and sin is deceptive, and it's a slippery slope, and you find yourself at the bottom of the pit before you even knew what happened. For women, this means, yes, we admit, you sometimes have it pretty easy in this area. Your husband likely is a simple machine that needs a little warming up and can be satisfied quite easily, even quickly. But wives, you have a calling to intoxicate your husband. You have a call. Doesn't that mean some measure of creativity? You have a calling to intoxicate your husband, not just let him. There's a big difference. Read Proverbs 5, ladies, in view of what you're to do. Read it as though it's written to you. Let him be satisfied with your breasts. Let him be exhilarated in your love and exhilarate him in your love. Guys, I think Doug Wilson is right when he says that most men make love like a gorilla plays a violin. Your wife does not respond to sexuality quite like you do. I know Victoria's Secret would be, you know, that works for you on her. And if you did the leopard skin G-string, she's not going to be excited. She's... Words are important to your wife. I know you like to hit the home run and go around the bases as fast as you can. But wives like to stop the bases. They like to have picnics at the bases. I know it's not... That's not the way we play baseball. But it's not about our rules. It's about communicating love to them. So if they want picnics at each base, then we need to give picnics happily, wonderfully. Stop depriving them because you're lazy. That's really what it is sometimes, isn't it, guys? Stop depriving them because you're lazy. The physical stuff isn't so hard. It's the emotional and the verbal that sometimes is so very difficult for men. But we need to work. And you know what? A little goes a long way. A little goes a long way, guys. So you don't have to be a poet. I started writing poetry for Sarah a few years ago. Maybe 5-7 years ago, and it's bad. It's bad, you know, the very predictable rhymes all the times, you know, that kind of stuff. But she liked it. It was good. All right? Work at it. They'll be happy. Let me quickly talk about how this relates to the unmarried, the fifth point here, and we'll quickly wrap this up. How this relates to the unmarried. I want you to see that in this passage and in Song of Solomon, there's a free expression and escalation of sexual passion. There are no emergency brakes to be applied in the marital sexual relationship. Unless kids are around, then you have to hit the brakes sometimes. But otherwise, it's supposed to escalate. How many unmarried people think that the line is sex? And maybe that's been crossed a bunch anyway, but maybe if the line is sex, then anything before is, well, it's like going down the highway when you don't have your license. You're not speeding. But I like to go down the on-ramp and get up to the speed limit 55. And wow. And maybe a couple times now, you hit the brakes, you brought it to a stop, and no one got hurt. No one got pregnant. But your brakes don't work so well. I know that from my own experience. I know that from the experience of pastoring people. Brakes don't work so well. You know why? Because sexual passion isn't made to have the engine revved and then the brakes applied. In marriage, you rev the engine and you floor it, and it's like the Autobahn. There are no speed limits. That's the nature of the engine. It's the nature of the car of sexual passion. And you're playing with it and testing brakes occasionally and saying, that one was close.
We almost went 56. I think it was 55.5. And so we went on the speed limit, but that was only like 20 minutes. Maybe we can do it for 2 hours. Don't play with that. You know what making out and kissing and feeling and touching is called when you're married? It's called foreplay. Foreplay. Before. It's meant to be before. It's meant to go somewhere. It's not meant to be an exercise in and of itself. In marriage, you don't use the brake, but you get to floor it. So wait. Wait. It'll be better than you can imagine. And it will be better the more you have protected yourself. You will bring images and experiences of other women into your marriage, guys. You'll have memories of girls that your wife will not like. They never liked those girlfriends you had in high school. Don't talk about them. And you'll wish you could forget them. Let me talk about this last thing here. I could talk about that more. Well, I'll say this under that point. I'll say it means wait. But for those who aren't teenagers, for those who are of marriable age, it means you may need to grow up and get married. It may mean sexual passion is supposed to be expressed in marriage. Okay, I got to get me one of those. How do I get one of those? Oh, she would want someone who's mature and responsible and actually has a job. Okay, I got to get me one of those. You got to kind of back up the sequence, right? I want to have sex someday with my wife. I want to wait. Okay, how do I get married? Oh, you're looking for that? Okay, I got to get a job. Or maybe just start with a shower or something. Sexual passion can push you towards maturity very well, I think, if marriage is the goal, if marriage is where it's to be expressed. The last point here is this. Remember, marital oneness is a divine redemptive picture. And by that I mean that God forgives, He washes, He cleanses white, He restores sin, even sexual sin. He forgives. He removes transgressions. He buries all sin in the depth of the sea for those who have trusted in Christ, His death and His righteousness. His love was shown to you in the life and the death of Jesus who bought you. The word in the New Testament is redemption. He redeemed us, which means that He forgives us and frees us, but He bought us to be His own. So now we're redeemed to be reconciled to Him, to be fixed, not just forgiven, to be restored, not just rescued. And that means that your marriage, even sex within marriage, uniquely shows you your sin in your selfishness. Doesn't it? And that's what I've been thinking this week. I can't believe how selfish I am. I can't believe how I can pretend like this is a loving thing. And really, it's the least thing I could do without having maybe a confrontation. And really, it's about me loving self and not my wife. Oh, it exposes sin. It's painful. But we need that so that we see the cross again in our lives. But marriage also, sex itself also pulls us outside of ourselves to love someone more than ourselves. That's a wonderful thing. In this marriage relationship, in God's plan has been chosen to be a key picture in which His love for us is shown, where we sacrifice to love our spouse in an intimate way. And the result is a relationship of oneness, of commitment, of sacrifice, of intimacy, of oneness, of exchanging love and life together. Now, I don't think Proverbs 5 or the book of the Song of Solomon are analogies of God's love for us. I think they're actual stories, histories of human love, a man to a wife and vice versa. But you can't read Song of Solomon. You can't read Proverbs 5. You can't read, I hope, any passage about marriage in the Bible and not remember that God has used this unique relationship to be a unique representation of His love for us and the unity and communion that we share with him. So let me close with these wonderful words of this analogy from the book of Zechariah. It says, like a bridegroom rejoices over his bride. That's wedding night language. The groom rejoicing over his bride. Like a bridegroom rejoicing over his bride, God shouts over us with songs of loud singing. He shouts with loud singing of excitement and joy in us. Who are we that he would forgive so much? Now forgiven, we want to picture what he's done to us and through us in our marriages. May it be so that another generation is raised to do that better than we ourselves are doing it or will do it.